G'day and welcome to Workhorse, the podcast about Royal Australian Air Force C-130 Hercules aircraft. Today we're talking about operations in Antarctica and airdrops at Macquarie Island. I'm your host, Bill Korolakis. Some of you know me as K-9. I served over 30 years in the Canadian and Australian Air Forces, primarily in air mobility roles. In this historically informative podcast series, I cover the entire history of Australian C-130s, including a look at how Australian history was shaped by Australia's Hercules aircraft. This podcast series is generally chronological, and it's based upon an extensive history book I wrote about Australian Air Force C-130s titled Air Mobility Workhorse, which should be published in 2024. Now, I don't imagine many of you have ever been to either the Arctic or the Antarctic. I've had the good fortune to have been to both. Ended up in the Arctic about 30 to 40 times during my flying career with the Canadian Forces, and I got lucky enough to get down to the Antarctic once as Commander Air Mobility Group on a C-17. The feeling of isolation, harsh weather, and risk involved in operating in Arctic settings or Antarctic settings is an adrenaline junkie's dream come true. I loved flying in that environment. And Australia has a substantial history in Antarctica, including aviation, but more so in exploration. So I'll talk to you a little bit now about Australia's history in Antarctica, and then we'll get on to how Hercs ended up in those regions. Sir Douglas Mawson was the driver behind the establishment of Australian interests in Antarctica. During two voyages conducted in the period of 1929 to 1931, as part of the British, Australia, New Zealand, Antarctica Research Expeditions, which was shortened down to BANZAIR, Mawson and the BANZAIR team claimed what would become Australian Antarctic territory by traversing the Antarctic coastline from about 45 degrees east to 160 degrees east. Based on this claim, and thanks to Mawson's lobbying after the Second World War, the Australian government decided to establish research stations at Heard Island, Macquarie Island, and eventually on the Antarctic continent itself. In August 47, the Australian National Antarctic Research Expedition, ANAIR, was formed to establish these scientific stations. And by 1963, Australia had established three of them on the continent, and they were called Mawson, Davis, and Wilkes, and that was later renamed to Casey. And they had scientists and meteorologists at each. These stations required every gram of supplies, food, and equipment to be brought to them from another continent. So there were great distances involved, and dedicated transport was required. Aviation wasn't initially used for dedicated long-range transport in support of ANAIR, but RAF played a role in Australia's Antarctic endeavors. A couple of pilots, Flying Officer Campbell and Pilot Officer Douglas, supported the BANZAIR mission by flying a Gypsy Moth surveillance plane on the 29 to 31 expeditions, conducting ice reconnaissance, photographic and geographical surveys. And the RAF returned intermittently to Antarctica over the following years, but in 1955 it established Antarctic Flight as part of the first permanent Australian presence on continental Antarctica. And they used Auster and Beaver aircraft, and in 1959 a Dakota, which was A-65-81, but it was later wrecked. And using those aircraft, Antarctic Flight provided surveillance, support, and point-to-point transport to the first stations on the continent. It wasn't until 1960 when thoughts turned to the possibility of requesting long-range resupply support from RAF C-130s. This suggestion came from a RAF officer who observed U.S. C-130 resupply missions to McMurdo Station, which is a U.S. research site in Antarctica. The concept didn't initially gain traction in Australia for a couple of reasons. Firstly, having just signed the Antarctic Treaty, Australia was reticent to conduct any military activity in Antarctica because that treaty demilitarized areas south of 60 degrees latitude. And that may actually have been why Antarctic Flight was not based in Antarctica after 1961, although I can't be sure of that. Additionally, the RAF did not consider the Antarctic mission to be core business, particularly when C-130s were needed for resupply of ADF operations in Southeast Asia, so the RAF wasn't overly interested in it. Despite those decisions, long-range transport flights to Antarctica remained of interest to ANAIR. Feeding ANAIR's arguments for C-130 support, A significant development occurred when the first direct Hercules flight took place between Australia and Antarctica on 30th of September 1964 from Avalon. This was flown by a U.S. Navy ski-equipped C-130 in support of U.S. research stations. So clearly, an air was watching this with envy. And in 1965, when RNZAF C-130Hs participated in the U.S. Antarctic resupply effort to McMurdo Station under the name Operation Deep Freeze, that envy just got even greener. And that operation ran yearly from 1955, but primarily out of Christchurch. The RAF finally returned to supporting Antarctic operations in March 1971, and then again in August 77, when Australian P-3s conducted male airdrop flights to Inair personnel on Macquarie Island. And P-3s continued to make those occasional airmail drops throughout the late 1970s. Concurrently, planning was underway to support mainland Antarctica with C-130Hs. A deal was struck with the U.S. to support their Operation Deep Freeze and its subset, which is called Operation Snowflake, for the 78-79 season. So the name Deep Freeze was the overarching Antarctic operation, and Snowflake was a more specific operation about flying scientists to McMurdo Station in the summer. In exchange for four RAF Snowflake missions from Christchurch, New Zealand to McMurdo, the U.S. provided resupply missions to Casey. McMurdo, approximately midway between New Zealand and the South Pole, was the logistics hub for the U.S. Antarctic program. And the local town is on Ross Island, and ice runways were created on the ice shelf between the island and the mainland. It was in Australia's national interest to support the U.S., both from the strategic point of view of supporting its allies and from the logistical perspective, because resupplying Casey was a challenge. Australia committed to four C-130H flights to McMurdo, and three crews were trained and sent on the operation. In late November 78, the crews flew to Christchurch in 005, one of 36 Squadron's newest C-130Hs, and it only had about 100 hours on the airframe at the time. The three crews set up a stagger for their flights under the call sign Aussie 5. The three aircraft captains were squadron leaders Stuart Dalglish and Dre Manis, and Flight Lieutenant Chris Richards. And those crews were well prepared for that operation. They had all observed New Zealand C-130 ops to Antarctica the previous year, and their preparation included survival training conducted in Antarctica, which required them to build snow caves and spend a few days on the ice shelf. They, of course, were given a whole bunch of survival gear, such as thermal underwear, heavy overgarments, muckluck boots, along with being the first in the ADF to receive the latest in immersion suit technology. Well, each mission departed from Christchurch, flying about 7 hours to McMurdo Station. Weather en route was monitored every half an hour, despite the difficult communications channels, and they needed to ensure that visibility and wind conditions would enable a landing. If the trend was showing a worsening weather pattern, the crews had to consider returning to New Zealand before they got to the points of safe return. Any sort of excess winds, blowing snow, sea fog, snow showers, whiteouts in the McMurdo area would have sparked those conversations in the cockpit. Arrivals at McMurdo were via a Tactical Air Navigation System ARC, or TACAN ARC, and once radar identified, a ground-controlled radar approach was flown to landing on the 3,000-meter-long ice runway. Prior to landing, of course, the crews had to consider runway conditions. The runway thickness needed to be 36 inches deep for C-130s, and of course, braking calculations were calculated on the assumption the runway was prepared properly by ensuring there were about 2 inches of snow on the surface to provide some friction, as opposed to landing on sheer ice. The ice runway was clearly delineated, and directional control, stopping, and maneuvering were generally not a problem. Stuart Dalglish landed the first RAF C-130 in Antarctica on the 1st of December 1978. Aussie 5 landed in a light snow shower without a hitch, and although Stuart later said afterwards that it was a bit hairy at times, it was uneventful. Having delivered 12 passengers and 24,000 pounds of cargo, Aussie 5 then prepared for the return mission, which was flown by a second crew that had been passengers on the first leg, and Stuart and his crew stayed at McMurdo, and then a slip crew rotation ensued. The crews had it lucky that year. Temperatures weren't too bad, around 0 degrees Celsius, and they had no issues with refueling, which they did using pre-positioned pumps and fuel bladders. The RAF's contribution to Operation Deep Freeze recommenced the following year, on the 2nd of December 1979, and continued for one more season thereafter. New crews came along. Of course, they got the benefit of talking to the crews that had been there already, and of course, they managed to deal with all the challenges that arose. And one thing I didn't mention was that these crews were taking off at about 160,000 pounds, because they wanted to carry as much fuel as they could, and some of them even took off at 165. And those crews also had to consider altitude, because when you get up really high down in the Arctic areas, you can get down to minus 56, which is, of course, the fuel freezing temperature. So you got to think about this as well when you're flying along in the Arctic areas. Well, the final season of RAF's contribution to Deep Freeze was flown in A-97-001, with the first flights taking place on the 24th of November 1980. The record keeping, I have to say, for the previous 2 years of the operation was pretty sparse, and there is no record of flights for the 80-81 season in the 36th Squadron unit history. Also of interest, the unit history recorded the 3 years of Antarctic missions under four different operational names. So the log had Deep Freeze, Snowflake, Antarctic Lift, and Ice Cube, all listed in various different places. Now, I already talked about the first two, Deep Freeze and Snowflake. Those were American names. I have no idea where Antarctic Lift came from, and Ice Cube was a Kiwi name. All right, let's switch gears a little bit here, and let's talk a little bit about Macquarie Island. During the late 1970s, an air continued to receive RAF support in the form of mail and supply drops at Macquarie Island. P-3s flew these missions on a roughly six-month basis, with P-3 drops occurring as late as June 1979. Situated about 1,600 kilometers south-southeast of Tasmania, and about halfway between Antarctica and Tasmania, the handful of Anair personnel on Macquarie Island, for example, there were only 18 people there in 1980, were stationed there for 12 months at a time. And of course, in the days before the internet and inexpensive phone calls, resupply drops were very welcome, and it was one of the few connections they had with home. I don't know who did this at 36 Squadron, but some entrepreneurial person realized, hey, you know, we can go and do some C-130H inertial navigation system in high latitudes and do some navigator training using grid or gyrosteer navigation techniques and do something operational all at the same time by going and doing some drops at Macquarie Island. So they contacted Anair and found out if they could do anything for the scientists at the island. Of course, they said yes. For those that are unfamiliar with what grid navigation is, it's a technique used when navigating without a reliable compass. It involves a particular type of chart called a polar stereo, or there are other charts you can use. And basically, you create a false north and set your compasses to run off of a gyro as opposed to a magnetic heading. And you steer using the gyro compass as opposed to a magnetic compass. And for those that have never seen it, when you get close to a pole, and it's actually still quite a distance from the pole, the compasses in the C-130 started to waffle. They would start slewing back and forth. And then eventually they would slew so far that they would just spin all the way around and then they wouldn't stop spinning. And that's because the compasses could no longer sense the horizontal components of the Earth's magnetic field, because as you get close to the pole, the magnetic field is going vertical and the compasses couldn't detect the vertical field because that's not how they were oriented in the C-130. Well, back to the airdrop. Of course, Herx could deliver much more than a P-3, so Anair said, yeah, bring it on, give us some resupply. Three C-130 training missions were flown in 1979, and as an example, one of them was captained by Ian Mallets, and on that particular mission, an Anair member, Philip Pritchard, came along, and they departed Hobart with a 1.8 cubic meter package prepared by Army Air Dispatchers, which had medical supplies, scientific equipment, mail, and rations. And they flew down there, took about 3 hours to get to the island. The crew was pretty lucky that day. There was good weather, it wasn't raining. The wind was only 30 kilometers an hour rather than the usual 75 to 100 kilometers an hour. And they conducted the drop on the isthmus of Macquarie Island, which is about the only bit of flat land near the Anair complex. And that drop zone is only about 100 meters wide and a few hundred meters long. And there's ocean on either side. And if you get it wrong, whatever you're dropping is going in the drink. So this relatively small drop zone with non-guided loads was pretty challenging, especially in gale conditions. The navigator on Ian Mallett's plane managed to get the bundle of supplies near the drop zone, and it was recovered intact. And they even let Mr. Pritchard throw out a bundle of newspapers, which then free fell to the ground. And they were actually newspapers printed that day, which is a pretty rare event for the Macquarie Island inhabitants to get an up-to-date newspaper. And lucky for them, the newspaper bundle didn't explode on impact. So the drops continued for quite some time. And the bulk of the loads going to Macquarie Island consisted of compacts. So 1 to 500 pound loads under a T-10 parachute or something like that. They also ended up dropping a lot of heli boxes or Dizzy Lizzies at the time. The largest number of loads dropped on any one sortie was flown by Doug Chipman, who was then CO-36 Squadron. And his navigator on that flight was Ian Scott, or Scooter. And they were in 009 on the 16th of May 1984 when they dropped 23 items, and most of those were compacts. There was one occasion where the Inair team asked if a Herc could drop a piece of dredging equipment up at a small lake on the plateau of Macquarie Island, and that saved them a whole bunch of trips taking bits and pieces up there and reassembling the dredging equipment up there. And that drop was flown in September 1980, captained by Ian Hawke in 005, and Shorty Heffernan was the loadmaster. And he said to me that the winds and turbulence at the drop zone were about the worst he'd ever experienced in his career. But in Shorty's normal way of expressing things, he said, "We got it there." It was a pretty popular place to go. Dick Smith was given a ride down there, and he wrote an article for the Australian Geographic in 1989. And he described a moment of his flights like this. "The Hercules gave an enormous lurch, and I was thrown to the floor. Even though I'd been warned to expect this, when we hit the 80-kilometer-an-hour wind shearing around the island's northern tip, Loadmaster Al White yelled across at me to lie flat and brace myself. I felt myself sliding towards the opening, and I grabbed hold of something on the bulkhead. The next 15 seconds were almost a blur as the plane bucked like a raft in the rapids." Well, his adventure was flown in August 88, and they were down there for over 2 hours, so he must have had a hell of a ride. Some of those Macquarie Island airdrop flights were later criticized for scaring penguins, and the accusation was that the penguins were so scared that they panicked and crushed each other. But actually, later evidence indicated that the flights that caused that were actually flights taking photographers over the penguin colonies to track their movements, not the Hercs. And in the mid-1980s, C-130Hs kept going down there about 3 times a year. And eventually the guys down at Macquarie Island learned to string cables on poles around the drop zone to catch any drifting parachutes, lest they end up down in Chile or somewhere else. That flying was really rewarding and challenging for the crews, and everyone loved going down there, but everything comes to an end, and flights to Macquarie Island ceased in 1989. Fortunately, flights back to Antarctica recommenced in the 2000s when C-17 started going down there. And we were able to get a C-130J to Antarctica in early 2020, which was a win for the Hercs, although it took a lot of debating with the air commander to get that done. Well, that's all for today. If you know anyone that loves military history or aviation, or even was just a passenger on a C-130, please tell them about the podcast. Thanks for listening.